everyone. Welcome to a brand new episode of Vodka O'Clock. It has been a while. I'm sorry about that. I'm your host, Amber Love, and thank you to everybody who's been supporting the show, the website, amberunmasked.com, and the brand new site, catdetectivecases.com, which is where you can find the weekly cat stories. So the Patreon backers are the lovely people who have been financially supporting me, which is great. And also thank you to everybody who's been, you know, resharing the links and buying books and doing whatever else you can. Just even a little DM to me, it's great. I've really appreciated that during the trouble times. So things have not started swimmingly, you know, ending 2022 and into 23. So it's been a rough patch, and I appreciate all that love from you guys. So to support the Patreon, you go to patreon.com/amberunmasked. Now to get to business at hand, finally an interview. And today joining me is this lovely creator that I met, could not believe that I ran into some people that I know at a show in New Jersey that I haven't seen in a long time. And I got to meet Emily S. Witten, who is one of the creators of books called The Underfoot. We're going to talk about that and just other creative things, because she has a really interesting path in the geek world. So Emily, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, it was just so much fun when we finally got to talk at your vendor table, because you write about hamsters and critters.
Yes.
That have their own adventures. And I was like, oh my God, we write such similar things. Mm-hmm. That's what my cat stories are about. You know, we have a chipmunk mafia. We've got a squirrel Supreme Court. We've, you know, we've got some, you know, Jersey Devil interactions and things like that. So I could not wait to hear and read such an original premise about hamsters, because I never had one. I had guinea pigs, I will say,
but so cute.
I'm a cat person. I've always had cats. So I just literally, other than watching Mr. Hamster on YouTube, which is amazing.
Yeah.
I don't really have any knowledge of the hamster world. So tell me about your hamster love. Was this from when you were a kid?
Oh my gosh, yes. And also, of course, there's a cat, at least one cat. Well, there's a few cats in The Underfoot, but one that you see more. So, you know, I am actually allergic to cats, which makes me very sad, because I really do love them. But I cannot be around them. So when I was little, I was not allergic to them. So I was able to be around them. We didn't have any, but like my family did. And so I loved visiting the family who had cats. And I was also in awe of them, because I didn't know what, like, how to deal with them, because I was just a little kid. So one time I was visiting my family and I was sleeping like on the floor, because there were a bunch of us, and I got up to use the restroom and I came back and the cat was sleeping in the warm spot, and I was scared to move it because I didn't want to wake it up. So I like sat up half the night waiting for this cat to wake up so I could lie back down. Which is a really silly thing, but I was like 6 or 7 years old, so I didn't know. But hamsters are great. Oh yeah. I mean, like, you don't want to move your cat, right? Like the cat, the cat is king or queen. The cat, it has the spot now. It's theirs. They just live there now. But I have had rodents as pets since I was a small child. And, the reason being that, we weren't allowed to have cats or dogs, cause like my parents just didn't want them to like mess up the house. Basically. They had had my parents had had like cats and dogs at various times, but they just didn't want them to be like, and we were young, so it would have been like chaotic and they would have had to take care of them, I'm sure. But because the reasoning I got was, well, we don't want them loose in the house, I determined that the best thing to do was get a caged pet. And so in second grade, I found at one of the book fairs, like a Scholastic book fair or similar, a book on why gerbils were great pets for small children. And I read this book. It was like a kid book with pictures. And I read this book and I gave a presentation to my parents on why I should have gerbils. And it worked. and they let me get gerbils. And so we had, and my sister also, like, we co-parented the gerbils, my sister and I. And so we had this pair of gerbils, and we loved them, and we played with them, and we took them to places they weren't supposed to be, like, that were off limits, and we played with them there anyway, and that led to some various adventures, like they got lost in the bathroom wall once and stuff like that. Yeah. Well, one of them did. And one time we scared my mom by accident with them by trying to, like, hide them when she was coming, and then she, like, discovered them and was like, oh my gosh. She wasn't scared of them. It was just startling. So I had a pair of gerbils with my sister, and then they lived for quite a long time. And then we got another pair, and they lived for a good time. And then, by that point I was, like, in high school. So we had, you know, a little break, and then I went to college, and I went to the pet store with my friend cause she wanted to look at the puppies, and I saw all the mice that they were going to feed to the snake.
Uh-huh.
And I felt really sad, and I couldn't rescue all, like, 100 mice, but there was this little tiny gold mouse, and I rescued that one and a friend for it. And so then I had mice. And they were tiny, and so they told me the wrong sex. They told me they were girl mice, which are less smelly, and they turned out to be boy mice, which are more smelly. But fortunately, I had, like, an open window. I could just leave them near because I had, like, a
radiator. At least it wasn't one of each, or you'd have just, like...
Oh my gosh, that would have been a problem. I would have had to do something about that, yeah. But they were the same. And the great thing about them, though, was that I had named them Ani and Tori after Ani DiFranco and Tori Amos, thinking they were girls. And then they turned out to be boys. And I was like, well, those are unisex names. It's fine. Yeah. So they were Ani and Tori, my boy mice. And that actually plays into the Underfoot, where we have twins named Ani and Tori, and one's a girl and one's a boy. And we never tell you which is which.
Right.
So I had mice. And they were great. And then after them, I got chinchillas, which are very not for kids kind of pets, generally speaking. They're more delicate. They have more, like, needs and everything. But they're really sweet, and they're so soft, like, so soft. Yes. So I had some really sweet, cute chinchillas. And then after they sadly passed away, I ended up getting a dwarf hamster. And I think I just went to the pet store and saw one and thought it was super cute. I think that's how I got the first hamster, was just like all these other, like, I saw a chinchilla and thought it was super cute. I was like, this is cute. And I didn't know you needed, like, a 2x3 foot cage to take care of it. So I got a little Chinese dwarf hamster, and they look kind of like a little mouse with a dorsal stripe. And they are the only hamsters that have tails that are, like, actual tails. They have little short tails, like an inch, and they're prehensile tails. So these hamsters are very good at climbing. So I had a couple of those, and then I ended up getting a different breed, and then another Chinese dwarf, and then my current one is a Roborovsky, which is the tiniest and most active little bugger you can get, like the little hyperactive hamster. And that was an accident. I meant to get a winter white, which is a chill hamster, and the pet store mislabeled them. Oh, yeah. And I was like, I hadn't had a winter white or a Roborovsky before. I was like, well, it's really tiny and cute. So I got it, and then realized afterwards when a friend who has Roborovsky, she was like, I think that snout looks like this kind of hamster. And I looked and I was like, oh, I didn't know they came in pure white. So it is a pure white little Roborovsky named Lumi, and she is a princess. She's very finicky. She is. She's a princess. But I love hamsters, and they're really interesting, and they're really companionable, and all my rodents have been. And hamsters are super easy. I don't want to overstate that. If you have young kids, you know, you still have to, like, you have to know how to deal with hamsters just like any other pet. But once you get to know how to, like, handle them and tame them and all of that, then they can be really good little chill pets, or entertaining, or both, depending on the temperament. Like, Lumi is not always chill, but she can be. And a lot of all my other ones were very chill after a while. Like, they'd get used to you. She is, sometimes she will, like, turn into a little hamster puddle, which is, like, what I call it when they relax. And most of the time she just wants to run around and eat all the seeds. So, but yeah, that's how I got into hamsters. All the rodents, and they're just super cute, and you can keep them in a smaller home. not too small, but like, you know, I don't have a huge home. So I'm like, it's city living. You got to have something you can care for. And I'm out of the home 8.5 hours a day on weekdays, pre-COVID anyway. And I travel for the comics. So
right. So I was going to ask how they do, or if there's anything that you need to, you know, hire a hamster sitter for conventions.
Yeah, well, if you can leave them for somewhere around, I feel comfortable leaving them for about 3-ish days or so without anybody looking in on them, because they don't overeat, and I give Lumi like a full water bottle, and after like a week, there would barely be anything gone. She drinks like tiny amounts of water and doesn't overeat her food, and they hoard. They're hoarders. So, in fact, we wanted to, at one point, we were thinking about calling the underfoot the hoard, because it is what you call a group of hamsters, and it is what they do with food. But our publisher, which is currently Oni Press, used to be Lion Forge Comics before they merged, and they thought it sounded a little too aggressive for a middle grade series. And also, we all had concerns about World of Warcraft and Confusion. So, exactly. But they hoard their food. So if I'm going for a little amount of time, I can leave her. And if I'm going longer, but I have like, you know, I have a friend or someone who can look in, I'll have them just look in on her. But also, I had a hamster who lived for 4 years, a dwarf hamster, and that is really old for dwarf hamsters. And by the time that we had to let her go, she had like 3 medications. So you can actually board them at an animal hospital. And so I would board Lily, my previous hamster, towards the end of things. And so through that, I really hadn't boarded a hamster. I'd had friends watch them and stuff. But through that, I found a good place. And so I boarded Lumi a couple of times for like San Diego Comic-Con and stuff, you know, longer trips. So, yeah, but they're pretty easy. You know, I usually ask them, I'm like, just put her in the ball once a day, let her run around, make sure she has food and water. And then one time I had to board her for 2 weeks. So they changed out the bedding for me and like cleaned the cage, you know. But they're great pets, and they're pretty easy.
I totally can see how, obviously, because the rodents that I that I get to write about, not that they're all outside, they should be.
yeah.
But they are very inspiring. And so they, you know, plus their interaction with each other and with, you know, with the birds and everything can be really, it's just interesting to watch. And I understand now where other, you know, legendary creators got their inspiration from nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like if you watch very old Disney and stuff and you think about how they could just, you know, a creator could just like sit in the woods. Like I even was thinking about Woody Woodpecker. I'm like, by the time I started hanging out around woodpeckers, I was like, holy cow, these things are that nuts.
They're pretty insane. I don't live near any, but I've seen them. I've been around them, and they're pretty insane.
They really are.
Yeah, I mean, nature is fascinating and science is fascinating, and I am not a professional scientist or a professional nature scientist, but I find it really interesting. And in fact, while I am not a professional any of those things, I did live in Yellowstone National Park for 2 months one time. Which was really cool. And yeah, so I got to see a lot of wildlife, sometimes by accident in circumstances where I kind of wished I wouldn't, like when I was on a hike and we ran into a grizzly bear and a herd of bison and, elk and stuff, elk with babies who are elk you don't want to be too close to, and moose with babies during the calving season and stuff like that. So, but still very cool. One time my friend got chased by a moose, which was not as cool, but it was funny afterwards.
Oh my God. What a story.
Yeah. 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 Well, we worked really close. I worked there. That's how I got to live there. I worked there during college, and we worked, about 3/4 of a mile from the place where we all lived. And there was a boardwalk through a swamp area, or a bog area rather, where moose live. And, he just happened to be coming home at the wrong time near a moose who was, you know, I assume being protective of its baby. And like, we were kind of sitting out on the front porch of the common area, and he came like booking it out of the woods through the parking lot going, moose! and it like chased him to the edge of the parking lot and stopped. Like, you're pretty lucky it's afraid of the parking lot, because, or like whatever, you know, it's that wise about humans that it stopped there.
Yeah, I really
very fast, really because am. Yeah, moose can run like if it had been running full tilt, or like I don't know when it started chasing him, but he would have been dead, because they can kill you.
They're enormous
and they're fast, and elk are fast. Like, all the animals are way faster than you might think when you see them like hanging out or grazing. Like bison, I think they're like 35 miles an hour or something. Like, I would say, don't quote me, but we're being recorded. Right. But you know, like, they're super fast. But nature is really interesting. We haven't gotten to write about a lot of Western United States nature in the Underfoot, because it takes place in the DC area at this time. But I love the West and all of its many strange natural creatures and features. So
it's interesting that you bring that up, because I'm East Coast also. I'm here in Jersey, and
yeah, you know, like my home state. Jersey is my home state. That's where I grew up. So yeah.
So like our bears, you know, we think of them as big, and then you see, you know, like an actual big, like you said, a grizzly. Like, they're just on a different level. And I've never been to the West to see those. Or I really want to see a moose. Not chasing me, though. But
Oh my gosh, moose are really cool. We used to go to Maine when I was a kid, and we would go on the moose trail early, early in the morning. Like, my dad would wake us up at, I don't know, it was probably 6 a.m., and we were like, no! But then we'd get out there on the trail and have a really good time, and we would see moose. And we saw moose, and I think we saw baby moose, like little, you know, mooselings, calves. They're called calves. But I just want to call them mooselings, because that's
mooseling
cute.
Is better,
right? But yeah, so I got to see some moose when I was a little kid, and then I saw a couple when I was in Yellowstone, and I definitely have seen elk, and we had visited a lot of the national parks out west. That was, my parents like those areas, so we had gone on like family vacations. That's what inspired me to like go work there, because I had been to all these national parks, and I loved out in the West. Like, I love that landscape. But moose are really cool. You don't want to see one chasing you. And grizzly bears are huge and scary. And the two things we learned that as we started working there, the very first two things they tell you during orientation are bear safety, and that you're living on the largest natural volcano in the United States.
Right.
Which is called the Yellowstone Caldera, and it shows up in the Underfoot as one of the potential ways that the world as we know it may have ended.
Right. So that's a perfect segue into what the stories are. So I want to, of course, credit all of your, you know, the collaborative team that brought this together. I mean, first of all, you and Ben Fisher co-writing sounds really fun, and like I don't know how that happened, other than you do give a wonderful you give a lot of great back matter that explains some things.
Yeah.
And so if you are curious about just how a conversation goes between Ben and Emily, then there are examples in the back of the book, and I have the first two volumes.
Excellent. Now,
your art by Michelle Nguyen, is that?
Yes, right? It's Michelle Nguyen is the proper pronunciation of her name.
Okay.
Which, and it is something that I had to learn as well. So
okay, yeah. So I've butchered that.
Fine.
Okay. Letters by Tom Zoller, which is how I met you, through Tom.
Yes.
And you also have, if you could explain Adrian's role.
Sure. So Adrian is Michelle's husband, and he did flatting for the book. So Ben and I co-created the series and co-write the book, and Michelle Nguyen is our artist. And artists, as you know, but as all of our listeners may or may not know, in the comics world, you know, it can be split up. So you can have like a penciler, an inker, a colorist, and in between those two, you can have a flatter, which is part of the coloring process. Michelle does everything. And so she can do the flatting as well, but flatting is a long process. And from my understanding, some artists find it tedious. And so Adrian, kicked in and, you know, did that work for you know, with her art. So Michelle does the drawings and she does the final colors, which is like the details and the shadows and all the, you know, the lighting, the nuance. But Adrian comes in and does what they would call the flat colors. And I am not an expert on this because I'm not an artist, but you basically fill in the basic colors that go with each of the parts of the piece. And then Michelle will do the like I said, the nuance or the shading. That's my very simple understanding of how it works. It might be more complicated than that, but that is Adrian's role. And then we,
how I understood it too.
So. Yeah. So, and then also, well, you might be about to mention our maps artists. I don't know if you had that on the list.
I didn't know, who was responsible for that, but it's incredible because I have notes here, you know, includes maps, organization charts, these reports from like the government and stuff.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Cause I'm a nerd. I mean, Ben's a nerd too. We're both nerds. Yeah. So the maps in the, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying, so that might fall outside the realm of whatever Michelle did as far as the sequentials. So,
yes,
you know, plus you have like the bios and the files or whatever on each of the hamsters and the teams, which was very helpful because there are a lot of critters.
But she
also draws them so well that you can tell one from the other. Like if I were looking at a cage of hamsters in the pet store, I don't know that I could tell one from the other.
Absolutely.
You know, color. But Michelle does such an amazing job. And, you know, so I didn't know if she was responsible for all of that non-sequential art stuff too.
Yeah, so the breakdown is the front maps. There's two maps for each book. There's a world map and a borough map. And so the first book, Eric Orchard, who is a creator and illustrator in his own right, like an award-winning Canadian illustrator, who I met through Ben, who had worked with him before, had known him before. He did the maps for the world and the borough in the first book. And then in the second book, we adapted his world map, Michelle, actually, to add some of the information you discovered in book one to the book two. And then Tom Zoller, who, of course, also is other, as well as being the great letterer of The Underfoot, he is an artist, writer, creator, does all the things in his own right. And he did the map for the second book because Eric wasn't available at the time. He was doing other work. So actually, I am the designer of the maps to a great extent. Well, no, Ben and I designed the names and everything for the world map together. And that the world map is obviously based in DC, but I am the designer of the borough maps. So I designed the maps and then Eric and Tom executed the maps for the boroughs. And then Michelle does the interstitials, except that, the org chart was done by Tom. So, and the org chart was, that one's all me. But the interstitials are usually Ben and me creating together. So the science and history pages and the character pages, we do them together. I probably have a slightly heavier hand in some of that because, some of it is, you know, DC based and or weird science, but Ben's also, you know, put in parts of that as well. So that everything comes from both of us, but the org chart is definitely me, as are the borough maps in terms of design. Execution was done by Tom and Michelle. So yeah, but I mean, I work for the government in my other job, as people may or may not know. And so org charts and government organizations are a thing I have had to learn in my time here in DC. So it's pretty funny actually, because the first book came out in 2019 and the second one came out in 2021. And so the script was finished pre-COVID, or was being finished right at the, I believe like right. Yeah. It was like right around the, I forget exactly, but the script was already, you know, either finished or well on its way. The interstitials were still being finalized because that, you know, came along and it comes along at a slightly different pace. We know what's going in, but like, you know, we might not have written it all out to be explanatory in the way that we do. And so we had an extra page because the book map, the way that we laid it out, we had one page. And so our editor, whose name is Grace, And she changed names because she got married. But she's amazing. And she said that we have this, you know, this one page left. What do we want to do with it? And I said, I have an idea. And so I made the org chart. And so because it was like during COVID at that point, I put in government agencies within our fictional Department of Preparedness, which had existed pre-second book. The Department of Preparedness was from the beginning. I was like, I'm making up an entire cabinet level government agency, and it's going to be like, you know, preparing for world disasters and national disasters and whatever. And then I put in all the agencies that I would have liked to have seen centralized at that time. So there's like an Office of Mental Health and Wellness, and there's an Office of like testing, like countrywide testing and everything. And so the top half of the org chart is very standard government agency, and the bottom half is all the smaller sub-agencies that I would have liked to see in a government cabinet-level agency at the time we hit COVID. And within that, there is a small, small subset that's the hamsters and the scales. And so they're a part of all of this. And the concept from the beginning was that the government had been testing on animals, and because they knew bad things were coming, you know, they knew that there could be disasters, and that's why the Department of Preparedness came to be. And they were testing on animals and gathering information from animals. And then they tested on these hamsters, and then the bad things happened, but they hadn't tested on humans yet. So the hamsters have fared better than the humans and the other animals, some other animals. So that's why if you're into book two, it's Hamster Adaptation Methods, Scientific Testing for Environmental Research, which spells hamster as an acronym. Because I'm a big old nerd. And
yes, there's a lot of great acronyms.
I appreciate that. That comes from my dad, actually, to a certain extent, before the government, because he worked at AT&T for many years, and he had a division that he was the head of, and he would come up with great acronyms so that he could put them on, like, windbreakers with a cool logo that the whole team could have, stuff like that. So one of them was called MAUI, like Hawaii, you know, and it was like a person sitting under a palm tree with a laptop. So thanks, Dad. And then I went into the government where everything is acronyms. So a hamster existed from the first book, and then scales came into being in the second book, which is the Scientifically Collected Adaptation Library for Extant Species. And that's the other branch of the little sub-agency that's doing the experimentation, which is Genetic Engineering Modifications for Survival, otherwise known as GEMS. So our hamsters and our scales are the GEMS of the Department of Preparedness. And that's how nerdy and deep I get when it comes to this stuff.
It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. I can only imagine that the notes that you have on the side, like the things that don't get into a script.
You
got a great file folder, and I'm imagining you're much more organized than I am.
Ben and I developed the series for 7 years before we pitched it. And so I really want to go back to some of our, we have all the notes because we did it through WhatsApp at the beginning, through chat. We talk on the phone as well, but we had a lot of back and forth. Whenever we had an idea, we'd just kind of chat at each other. And I really want to go back and read through those because there's so many ideas that changed or did not make it in or have not yet been explained. And I want to see if any of those are things that we should be throwing in there now. I haven't had a chance to do it because, you know, everything just keps clicking along.
And how relative you want to make it to what's happening in the real world. And
yes,
it's, you know, obviously that comes through, and it's just something in the zeitgeist. I mean, we're all writing about things that we're going through in different ways. I just, you know, finished, I don't know if you read Chuck Wendig. I read Wayward, which is the sequel to Wanderers. And
okay, I haven't read it, but I'm familiar. So
yeah, so again, it's about, you know, this big global pandemic phenomenon, and you know, and that's just one of them, because then I also read Chris Holmes' Child Zero. And mm-hmm. And then in the comics world, I went through the two volumes of The Underfoot, and then a new book coming out, or just came out, Scurry by Mac Smith.
And oh, I've heard of that one. I haven't read it yet, but I've heard good things. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, it's you know, it's phenomenal that even when we have some sort of similar concept of, you know, like, where are the humans? What's happened to the humans, or what happened to their population, or are they only mm-hmm. located in one city? Like, you know, The Walking Dead did its thing.
Yeah.
You know,
I love The Walking Dead, even though I hate zombies.
Okay.
it's great for character development, having a situation like that. And I love the characters. And of course, you know, Daryl's my favorite, because I'm a follower. No, I'm kidding. Because he is, because he's the coolest character in the freaking series. But and he, you know, he does make it to the, well, anyway, so yeah. Spoiler alert. But
we have these, you know, everything, and this goes back to, you know, a lot of B movies took on this idea as well. But the, you know, how different and unique they could be, like, you know, your interaction between the animals is different. Like the cats are, you know, like, very terrifying and scary, and yet in, I think, unless I'm confusing the two now, I might be confusing them.
Well, the cats may or may not be terrifying and scary. Yeah. So, right. So it starts out one way and maybe goes another way. not to go too much into it, but yeah.
So the cats get out of their cages. The dogs are out in the wild, and they've been affected a different way.
Well, we don't have, we don't have dogs, but we have wolves. We have wolves. And this is another one of those weird science things. We have what are called coy wolves, or I don't know how you even pronounce it, but they're coyote wolves, and they exist in real life. So they're a crossbreed that is out there in the world. And we put a little bit in our second book about the science of coy wolves. So that's what's chasing them out in the underfoot too.
Yeah.
is a coy wolf.
So that's, like, really scary. And
yeah.
To think the cats could be, you know, when they've gained this intelligence, the cats could be like, okay, we're not going to bother you. You don't bother us, or whatever. And then, as you said, the scales, we've got the mm-hmm. reptiles and iguanas and, like, snaky things. And how, you know, they've like, trying not to get too spoilery, but
I know it's hard when you have two whole books to deal with.
And there's
they have a different perspective on what happened to them, for sure.
They have a
different worldview than the hamsters and some of their fur brethren and sistren. There's a definite conflict going on there, and that part is on the back of the book, so we can say the hamsters and the scales do not get along, and the scales may or may not be justified in some of their readings of what happened. You know, one of the things, like, you know, they say, oh, don't read your reviews, but of course everyone's gonna look when their book comes out and be like, has anyone actually read it? And I read one review with Underfoot 1 early on, where they were like, I really liked it, but they really should have gone into more, like, the ethics of animal testing and this. And I was like, well, we're only in book one of three. So by book two, you do get, and we're not making necessarily specific commentary, but we're letting our characters share how they were treated by the humans. Right. And by book two, we've dumped in some science about real tests that were done on lizards that irradiated them. Which is, in fact, connected to what happened to some of our scales friends, including Hashak, our main villain. So the scales have a different view of what happened to them, and it does feed into, everything is so connected in my head. And hopefully it comes out in the books, you know, and Ben's head as well, obviously. Like, when I say my head, we're writing together on all of this.
Yeah. The hive mind.
Yeah. But when you look at that org chart, there's a reason that we named the scales. It's an adaptation library. So it's scientifically collected traits. So the hamsters are getting the benefit of the experimentation, but where is it coming from? Well, it's possibly coming from other animals and experimentation done on them that is not so positive. And so we put it in there, but it's not the, like, Ben and I both hate preachy books. And especially if you're writing for a young audience, they'll pick that up right away, like preaching at you, like, here's this vocabulary word, it means this. So we put in challenging concepts and we put in bits of commentary that maybe are just in the background of what's going on. And while I do appreciate people's like, well, they should have addressed this, we are addressing it. It's just that we're not telling you how to think about it. And I think that's fair because there could be some benefits to research that's being done with animals. And yet there's an ethical argument to be made for cruelty to animals and the unfairness of that, treating, you know, little creatures like that, or big creatures. And so it's not a black or white idea to me. So I don't want to tell people this is what you should think about it. And obviously, you know, when you write, it's not necessarily your voice or your opinion coming out anyway, but people are going to assume it is a lot of the time.
Exactly. They're going to think that that's, you know, if you write a racist character, that makes you a racist. And it's not.
Right. Unless you, yeah, depending on how you're, yeah, depending on how you're portraying it. But like, I like to throw it in there and be like, what do you think about it? I don't know. See what you see, how you feel, you know?
So did your editor have to coach in that line and say, you know, well, this age group, you know, might need more information or might need less information?
So we developed the story with no set age group. And then when we pitched it, they recommended the middle grade and they did not tell us to do anything or stop us from doing anything except language and violence, where we didn't write in any extreme language, which we didn't want to anyway. We weren't interested in that. And we had a discussion early on about one of the violent scenes that happens in book one, where they're fighting a non-intelligent animal that's hunting them. And that we just kind of had a chat about the level of like blood and violence that we could see. And that's about it. You know, the books get dark in certain places. There is character death, not to spoil anybody specific, but there's character death. There's more than one character death. Some of it is played for, you know, heroism. Some of it is played for tragedy. Some of it is played for sadness, you know, like depending on what's going on. And there's violence and there's scary stuff and there's darkness in the, you know, the scales and what they're doing and all kinds of stuff. And in fact, book three, which, to go back, the COVID stuff and the way the world is heavily on our minds as we're developing the next story, which did not, you know, none of that existed when we wrote book one, but we were looking at post world, you know, our world scenarios is post-apocalyptic. So, you know, it's out there, but now it's a different kind of out there. And so how does that affect what we were originally doing? Does it affect it or not? So we're thinking about all of that, but there's darkness in there. There's different scary stuff. And our editor is really more focused on, you know, are there plot holes? Are there too many mysteries going on? Obviously also the technical aspects of it, but a lot of these story, you know, building, like, is it clear who all the characters are? Are we, you know, overwhelming the reader? Because it is a, you know, an ensemble cast, as you said, and it is very large. And then we add more characters in book two with the second group of hamsters. And I know, like, one of the critiques some people have is there's a lot of characters, and I get it, but that's the way the story is. That's the story we wanted to tell. So, you know, our editors, like scientific concepts, we generally have, you know, been cognizant of treading the line of, like, these are potentially middle grade readers, although we have a lot of adult fans as well, you know, at middle grade and up. But while in the main story, we try to write everything for an audience that could be middle grade and up, in the interstitials, we do not. So there are hard scientific concepts and big words. We write bits of the interstitials in a way that hopefully is explanatory to younger readers, including by having some conversations with the now gone humans and or about them teaching their children. But some of the stuff is emails between government officials or government employees, and it's scientific stuff, and it's not dumbed down at all. And the idea is you don't need that to appreciate the story, but it adds. So that's right. Kind of how we did it.
So you couldn't, I mean, it could be decorative, or, you know, if you take the time and read through it, then it gives you some explanation.
Right. I mean, we call the mushrooms, the glowing mushrooms in book one by their like scientific name, which is Pinellas stipticus, I think is how you pronounce it. And, you know, we go from there. We've got energy concepts about solar cell development. We've got ham radio and how radio waves work. You know, we've got all kinds of like concepts that are really not things that kids would necessarily understand. And I mean, there's also references to like songs they've probably never heard. So there's like in book two, there's a reference to, there's a reference to Golden Brown by the Stranglers. I don't know who, and to numbers codes and like different stuff that kids are not going to know anything about that, but maybe this will interest them and they'll learn about it. And that's kind of part of the point, is like some of the mystery is, what is this thing? And, you know, kids have the internet now, so they can find some of this much, much more easily than we might have when we were kids. But even if it's just a background concept until they're older, they'll maybe remember it and be like, oh, yeah, in that book this was mentioned, and now I'm 18 and I'm hearing about it somewhere else. And now I know a little bit about how it could be used, or whatever the case may be.
There are plenty of Easter eggs for the older generation.
Oh, so many.
in fact, we'll talk about a couple of the hamster teams here, because
we
have the main group that we first meet is the hamster aquatic mercenaries. Now, I'm not knowing anything about hamsters. Do they actually swim?
So you're not really supposed to like throw your hamsters in the water. So chinchillas, you're not supposed to get wet at all, because their fur is so dense, it's hypoallergenic, and it's so dense that they can get like fur rot. And so chinchillas, like you should not get them wet. And if you get them wet, you have to blow dry them, which is a fun fact that I learned after my chinchilla sadly got injured through no fault of anybody's, and had to be like washed and stuff. Hamsters are a little more hardy in that respect. They don't have that thick fur, so that's not going to be a danger to them. But they live in slightly different climates, you know, coming from the wild. But they're not actually water creatures generally. My hamsters will take, and my chinchillas did too, pumice or sand baths. So it's like very fine sand made of like pumice, and it cleans the oils out of their fur. And chinchillas are really fun. They'll flip around. It's like you get them something that looks like a birdhouse with a curved bottom, and you put sand in it, and they'll just like flip around in there. I mean, you can do other stuff too, but that's like easy. And this hamster that I have now, Lumi, she, like I said, she's a princess. So if I put her in her sand bath thing, she will just kind of walk around it and maybe dig a little. But if I take the sand and rub it into her fur, she loves it. So she makes me do the work, but usually if a hamster is going to have a bath, it's a sand bath, and it takes the oils out of their fur. So there's definitely fictional elements. And one of the main fictional elements is the science fictional elements is that the experimentations that were done on these creatures gave them special abilities in different directions. Right. So as we get into book two, and of course, even in book one, you do get information about what specialties there are in the makeup of the hamsters. But by book two, it's made more explicit that the ham can hold their breath longer and have a denser skeleton and have a water-resistant fur in a different way than the later group that you meet, the hap, who have lighter bones and are more like akin to what birds would have, and live in trees as opposed to living on the ground like most hamsters, or in the ground like most hamsters would. So there's a lot of license being taken. There's a lot of hand waving going on. But the concept being that the humans were developing these different traits, seeing how they could adapt themselves by seeing how they could adapt animals, and the animals adapted. They got different genetic traits out of this.
Right.
Who knows if anyone could actually do this, but they have made mice glow, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I was going to say, they've made several animals glow.
So, I mean, we're doing this stuff, and I knew about the glowing mice before, like, Underfoot 1 came out. So we know it's possible to do stuff like this, even if we haven't done this stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And, yeah, very, like, Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And luckily, you know, as I said, you do have these wonderful, like, cheat sheets in between the stories and stuff. So, or in between the chapters, that give you their traits and their special skills. And Ruby, mm-hmm. the little one.
Oh, bebe. Yes.
Yeah. So precious. I love that team up.
Ruby and Mac. I love it so much. And Ruby is a Roborovsky. She's the breed of hamster that I currently own. She was written before I owned that kind of hamster, but I was aware of, you know, all the breeds. And I have, like I said, I have a friend who has had pairs of them, you know, over time. They don't live for that long, unfortunately. So Ruby is the tiniest breed of hamster. The littlest hamster is what we called her early on. And Mac is a unruly teddy bear hamster, tomboy kind of gal.
Which is with this big, curly, like, wild hair. And
yeah. Oh, my gosh. Google teddy bear hamsters if you haven't seen them. They are wild. And they are – oh, can I tell a fun teddy bear hamster story?
Sure.
I have been fortunate enough to get to know some amazing authors over time through some of my other work, running conventions and organizing conventions, and also being a journalist prior to this work. I wrote for Comic Mix, and I did that for about like 7 years. So I was reporting on things and doing all the stuff at the conventions. But through my work organizing the Discworld conventions for Sir Terry Pratchett, one of my favorite authors of all time, I met, shortly after I started working on that, I met Neil Gaiman. And so I've known Neil for a while now. And I found this hamster during my research of just looking at hamster pictures that is a teddy bear hamster. I still have the picture somewhere because I saved it into my research, but it was a teddy bear hamster that was mostly black hair, but with gray and white running through it, like gray and white strands, and a teddy bear, which means its fur was just all over the place. And so I messaged Neil and I said, I'm going to name a hamster after you. Is that okay? And he was like, yeah. And I sent the picture and he was like, perfect. And so in the end of book one, in the beginning of book two, et cetera, you meet Neil, the hamster, and Terry, the hamster. And they are, in fact, both named after Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. And Neil has crazy fur and is a teddy bear hamster. And Terry has a little white under her chin, which is like the Terry Pratchett white beard. And he always wore a black hat. And so Terry is black hamster with white beard and belly. And the fur on top has kind of a little, like, it's like almost like a little curl to it. And we didn't give her a hat because Buddy has a hat and they're both sharpshooters and they can't both have hats. That's ridiculous. But yeah, so the Neil hamster was Neil approved and was inspired by a picture of a teddy bear hamster because they are wild. They have this crazy hair. And if you own one, you have to comb them. You have to groom them. If they are left to their own devices as pets, in the wild, they deal with themselves, obviously. But as pets, if they're left to their own devices, they will get like knots in their fur. And in fact, I'm not an expert on how they were developed, but it's possible that they don't exist in the wild. I don't know, but I would not be surprised to know that these are domesticated only, and that's why their fur needs care from humans.
I'm not what we've done to cats and to dogs.
And dogs, So, I mean, I know a lot about hamsters. I don't know absolutely every single thing about them, but my guess would be that probably in the wild, hamsters, you know, their fur isn't quite that insane. But, it's such a joy to look at pictures of teddy bear hamsters because their fur is insane. I love it. It's just so funny. But yeah, so Mac has crazy hair, crazy fur. Mac,
yeah, and she's a sweetheart, and you know, but about Ruby, like Ruby's talents are very different from the rest of the group. We were talking mm-hmm. about science, and there's a lot of engineering, and it might, yes. you know, thinking about how kids might think, I don't know, but I've been watching Abbott Elementary, and they do the egg drop. And it's the eighth graders versus the second graders, and the mm-hmm. second graders have no clue. They just want to see an egg fall from the ceiling, you know, like,
it's, yeah. And the egg drop type of experiments were very on our minds when we did the toothpick experiment or the toothpick test, basically.
Yeah.
That is definitely the kind of thing that, you know, we did in school and remember being a part of our learning. So yeah, absolutely.
We did a different egg one where it you had to create a container that you could step on and it wouldn't crush.
Oh, that you could step on. Oh, I think ours were the container that you could drop, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
But I think it is a common thing in schools, or at least it has been.
Yeah. So it was interesting to see. And even Bob's Burgers, which I'm, you know, I can relate everything to Bob's Burgers. Louise gets this puzzle mm-hmm. and she figures out how to solve it. And then in real life, they have a situation where Linda's arm gets stuck and they have to figure out how to get Linda's arm out. And Louise is like, oh, it's like my puzzle.
And, you know. I haven't seen that, but that, yeah, it's exactly that kind of thing. It's like not everybody has the same skills, you know?
Yes.
But we did have a lot of fun, and this is, again, we go really into the details. So Ben and I had a lot of fun developing Ruby's character card, which has everything crossed out. She's not good at anything at the yes. beginning of the, you know, you see her character card after chapter one of book one, like, so you don't know her that
fail.
Well.
Yeah, like she's not going to have like aquatic graduation. Swimming's not her thing. And
yeah, she's not going to make it into the elite hap of the, or the elite ham, sorry, the elite ham. She's going to be like, she's going to end up working in the borough somewhere and we don't even know where. She can't do maintenance. She can't do inventory. She can't do like any of the things. Now we've put her into ham to see if she can train in ham, and that's not going well either. She needs swimmies. She's not a good swimmer. Like, she's a real weirdo. And
yes.
And knows it, but she's still very persistently herself. But we had so much fun describing her traits by comments from her teachers, you know, like, or her, you know, they're basically her teachers, the trainers. And like everything they tried to assign her to do, she's bad at some part of it. Like, she's weirdly bad at it. It's not like just bad at it. It's like, she's like, got something else going on in the way her brain works. And, you know, there are geniuses out there and they got weird brains and sometimes they make the world go round. And so, you know, Ruby's a little engineering genius, but early on, she's like a sad little hamster who doesn't swim well and can't do anything and gets lost in the woods. And she's just not very good at certain stuff. And that was really fun to write.
And that's why, you know, and then so Mac is assigned as her protector, and Mac is so serious about that job.
Oh my God. She's so loyal. She's loyal and she's steadfast and she's just, I love those characters together. We love writing them. And poor Mac getting beat on, not physically, but like emotionally by her mom, who is the head of the borough. And I mean, you don't know that right away, but eventually it is figured out. And her mom looks like a freaking queen. You know, she's all coiffed and like her fur is perfect and she wears a little cute doll necklace and like, she's the head of things, Luciana. And then poor Mac, the little tomboy who's never going to get anywhere because her mom won't let her do, you know, the ham and whatever. And yeah, the dynamic of Luciana and Mac and then Mac and Ruby are some of my favorite things that have come out of our writing. To be honest. Yeah.
And then part of that character construction is their names. As you said, you've got the Neil and Terry Easter eggs and the Tori and Ani, because we've got in book one, we're really focused on musicians. And they you know, they see these like records on the wall, and you know, who knows if they are familiar or about what it is, but where they're growing up and where their home is surrounded by all these names that they see.
Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit more backstory to that. Yeah, they have what, as you're mentioning, they have the naming room, and that's how they name their little pups, the hamster pups, as they go and they see the records and the CDs. And all of the Ham are named after musicians. Some are referential to New Jersey, actually, because Count Basie, a great musician, there's the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey, which is where I saw the first ballet I ever saw, the Nutcracker, when I was a kid. And it has great acoustics, the Count Basie Theater. It's a beautiful theater, old school, amazing. And Count Basie did an album that has an atomic explosion on the front. And so we put that in there specifically because it's another like world disaster. Yeah. But yeah, so yeah, I can't remember. I think all of that might have come out of the Onitori thing, because I had named, you know, mice after musicians, mm-hmm. and we had that twin idea early on, and I think that might be where the music names came from. But the idea of all the names coordinating somehow came out of either that and or the idea that there are remnants of the human experimentation and how their ancestors were developed in the current group. So that is that, and yeah, and in fact, I don't know if I'm actually going to pull out my book and check to see if this is the case in the map, because I don't know if it made it into the map. Yeah, so you can't, it's not in the book to map, but I think it's in one of the pages where they're practicing or something is going on. I can't remember, and it's my own book, or mine and Ben's book, you know, our Michelle's, et cetera, our book. But somewhere in there, the jumpway, which is where they practice their jumps in the HAP group, where it's like the hollowed out tree trunk where they practice their jumps. The idea was that the bottom was lined with sci-fi books, sci-fi and fantasy.
Right.
Because these hamsters theoretically have scavenged some of the, you know, things from their human world when they first got out back out into the wild from where they were. Which we don't know a ton about where they were, but we do. Ben and I know. We know a lot about where they were.
Yeah, so the tree map is pretty cool, because you see like the glider shop, the archive tower, the room of mysteries, the cafeteria.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we have a lot of fun with you know, figuring out what everything is going to look like and how they live, you know, they're different, the burrows and everything. And I love the saucery. It's a flying saucer wheel. I have one for my hamster, and it's like the angled wheel that little hamsters run on and sometimes fly off of, which is pretty hilarious because they run so fast and they just whoop right off the wheel. Luby does it too. But yeah, so it was a lot of fun kind of designing both of the burrows, because the Ham have an underwater part of their burrow and the Hap have the tree related things. And in fact, the Hat, who you see coming in at the end of book two, their burrow is really cool. We have not seen it. And it is one of the weirdest things, in my opinion, that exists in DC, and they live in it. And oh my gosh, I hope that we get to the point where Michelle gets to draw that, and I maybe apologize in advance to her for making her draw it, because it's going to be weird. But yeah, you meet the different groups, and you meet some other hamsters that towards the end of book four, and in fact, they live again somewhere else, and we know where that is, and it's creepy. So we have cool and creepy and weird and all kinds of stuff in our story.
It's fantastic. I had such a great time and an emotional time, because the character development, this isn't, you know, like, it's not vapid. Like you're saying, there's a lot of work put into what the core characters are going through. And, you know, and that's not lost. Like, you know.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah, like Beck ends up on this whole journey, and
yeah,
then there's, you know, you're like, things get tense and then they get sad, and you know, so there's so much involved. I think it's just a breathtaking series, and I can't wait for volume 3.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. And you know, we didn't have that planned for Beck. We had a lot of this stuff planned out, but as you as a writer know, you know, things develop sometimes in different ways. Yeah, exactly. That's why we have all these notes from the beginning that are probably completely different from what turned out to be the books. But Beck was not, we didn't have that whole journey planned for him early on. And in fact, Beck was written to be a real pain in the butt, you know, like he's really annoying in the beginning and we don't like him.
Yeah.
He's an arrogant little hamster. But Beck turned out to have, I mean, I really like the journey we made for him, but we did not have all of that outlined at the very beginning. So that's kind of fun too.
That's amazing. So with, okay, I know Oni and Lion Forge are going through some things.
Question mark. Yeah.
Yes. So do you have specific plans for volume 3? Like when,
so volume three
how it's coming
is,
out or when?
Yeah, volume three is creationally, whatever you want to call it, in the works. Volume three has a lot of really cool stuff in it. It is kind of a jumble right now that we're working through in terms of creating it. In terms of what's going to happen in when it might come out or how it might come out, etc., we don't know. But we will. And one thing is, like, you know, Oni went through a bunch of restructuring, as we know. Between the first and the second book, our publishers merged. Our publisher merged, Lionforge merged with Oni. So we went through all of that, which was a big shakeup in the industry at the time. And now, between books two and book three, Oni has gone through a restructuring. And it, in my view, and Ben as well, we thought, you know, why push for something when we're still working on the thing? So we'll, you know, we'll definitely have a conversation once we have a little more to go forward with. You know, I'll be totally frank, COVID and the pandemic slowed us down some. I've had COVID twice. Ben's had it as well. The pandemic is insane. I have a full-time job that had to go full telework. During the week I had COVID the first time, because I got COVID in March 2020 the first time, and I was I was sick for like 3 weeks, and then I woke up one morning feeling great and went for a run and messed up my knee for like 6 months because I was so out of shape from lying on a couch for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So and I had long COVID where it came back in a cyclical way after the first one, and the second time I got COVID it lingered. So I had both forms of long COVID, or two of the forms of long COVID, one where it comes back around in a less severe, but, you know, cyclical way, and one where it just like lasts for a long time and you're fatigued and stuff. So, and Ben got COVID really badly when he got it. He got it later, but he got it really badly. And he, I think more intensely than even I had it, cause he had like a higher fever and stuff like that from my recollection. So, you know, everybody in the world has gone through stuff with COVID and the pandemic and continues to, and it slowed down our creative process for all the reasons that everybody else has been dealing with stuff as well. And so, you know, we're working on it. There's active stuff going on, but I don't have exact knowledge yet of like what's going to happen next, but I want to see book three come out. It's tons of stuff we've had in the works that is, you know, in our plans. Like I said, we haven't even seen the burrow for the hat yet, and we haven't seen the burrow for the hamsters that you meet at the end of book two. There's a different, you know, there are four groups by this point. There's the last group, there's only a couple that you see, but they're not that group. So they're yet another group, and like I said, they live somewhere else and they have different traits, and you know, so there's all this stuff going on. I want to see it develop. Ben wants to see it develop, and we're you know, hopeful that it can come out with Oni like the other two, and we can have a trilogy and maybe even like a slipcover someday. I can dream, right? I can dream. I would love to have our little trilogy in a little collectible thing, because I am old school like that. So yeah, I think that it's a work on the thing and then fingers crossed it'll all work out in the end kind of scenario when it comes to that. And I think that, you know, ONU's restructuring is settling down some now, which is good because that's coinciding with us having recovered from COVID and being able to work more on the book. So yeah, maybe it's all coming together. We'll hope so.
I hope so. So where can people keep up to date with that news and with you? And
yeah, so well, ONI has our books on their website, and I also have a website that's just the Emily ESSE, Emily S, .com. So it's the EMILYESSE.com. And that's also where I am on all social media, is the Emily ESSE. And Ben and Michelle are also on social media. Tom is on social. Everybody's on social media. And most of us have our own websites, I think. I do have an email contact, and I think I can't remember if I set up a newsletter thing. I need to check, because honestly, I haven't had time to go back to my website in a while. But if people email me through it, contact page, I do get those. I'm trying to be better about, like, hey, notification system. But you can definitely, like, keep an eye on ONI's website, and my social media will blow up with it if I have any news. And the big information right now is that we're sold out of book one. So there are no more new copies, to my knowledge. I know the ONI sold the last ones to me. The warehouse is empty, and I'm not sure when it's getting a reprint, if and when. But hopefully, if you know, we get book three rolling along, maybe we'll get a reprint of book one, because that would be great. Otherwise, how are we going to read book three?
yeah, you gotta get the roots here. You gotta get ham haps and hats and
I know you got to get it all lined up, but yeah, I mean, it's great that our run sold out. We're happy that so many people bought the book, but now we need, you know, more book ones so that people can read the book twos and eventually book threes. So,
and not only sold out, Ringo nominated.
Yes, wonderfully. Both of our books were nominated for Ringo Awards. We did not win, but we were really glad to be nominated, and we were in really great company and with some really great winners. And our Underfoot One, The Mighty Deep, is currently up for a Black Eyed Susan Book Award from the Maryland Library Association. So that the nomination came out a while ago, but it takes like a year, because this is an award that librarians and other members of the Library Association nominate these books, and then the students have to read a certain number of them before they are able to vote on the winners. So they are given time to read the books. And so, like, my understanding is that the winners are announced right before the next nominees. So you get like a year. So who knows how that will do. But yeah, our first book, The Mighty Deep, was nominated for two different awards, and then The Underfoot Into the Sun, which is book two, was nominated for a Ringo. And I'm very glad that people are enjoying our books to that extent and valuing them, because we put so much into them, as you can tell, and we love them, and we think they are worth reading, hopefully.
And what's your Instagram so that people can see pictures of Lumi and...
Oh my gosh, yeah, go for the hamster pictures. Stay for the occasional posts about food I've cooked or places I've gone. everything is the Emily ESSE. So Instagram, okay. Twitter, which I'm not on quite as much now, but... and then I do have a Facebook public page that's also that, but to be honest, I don't really keep up with that one as much. But yeah, website, Instagram, Twitter, the Emily ESSE everywhere.
Okay, yes, because you want to absolutely get your dose of cuteness.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And you know, like your animal posts are adorable as well. And like, I love animal Instagram is my favorite thing, and the algorithm has been trained. So, like, all my suggestions almost are just cute animals.
Mine too. I'm like, that is my purpose of Instagram.
Absolutely. Yeah. What else is it for? That and humorous statements and little reminders to take care of your mental health.
Yeah, exactly. And even those are done in, like, comic strip form now. It's like,
you know, yeah. Instagram is the best of the social medias right now, I think. And Facebook, if you use it just to keep up with some friends and family, as opposed to for all the weird stuff that used to be on it before they maybe moderated it better again or whatever happens.
Well, I've joined the Hive Social. So,
I'm on that and Mastodon, same thing, but I haven't used them much.
Yeah, so there's some slow building there over on Hive, but it's getting there.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, I don't know if you're, I'll add you on my end and vice versa. But I'm the same over there. It's the Emily ESSE, S is in Sam. And I'm on Mastodon and I'm on co-host, I think, but I haven't really done anything with that one yet because there's already so much out there. If Twitter goes away entirely, I guess that's, you know, one of those will emerge. I don't know.
Right.
I don't think Twitter is going to go away. It's just changing in really annoying and unfortunate ways continually.
I was going to say, it's just changing for the worse. So
yeah, the for you versus following took me a while to figure that one out. I don't know if other people have noticed that it now defaults to suggested for you instead of the people you're actually following, and you have to swipe, swipe left in order to get to the things you actually want to see without like the algorithm suggesting stuff you might not want. And I have noticed that if you go with the algorithm, there's more stuff that will make me mad than if I just go with the things that my friend, I'm like, I curated this for a reason. You guys, I don't want my social media to ruin my day every day. You know, yeah. I can read the news on like AP, Reuters, Bloomberg, you know, like some of the less biased, you know, news sites just to get the basics. So anyway, but yeah, that's me everywhere. The Emily ESSE.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time and joy.
Oh my gosh. Thank you.
You know, I appreciate it. I know it took us a while to figure out scheduling and stuff because we've got different oddball hours that we're working around. So I appreciate that. You know, enjoy your, you know, if you drink coffee, I have mine ready. So
I don't drink any caffeine. I have natural, I'm naturally caffeinated, but
you are like, I mean,
yeah,
it's very impressive.
Oh gosh. Well, not when I need like a little break around 3 p.m. and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so tired. What happened? But yeah, no, coffee's not for me. If I drink it, I get the jitters. So I don't touch it most of the time unless I'm like driving really late at night and I need it to be alert. But enjoy your morning coffee. I'm so glad that you're interested in our little hamster books. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about them, of course.
Thank you so much, Emily. And thank you, everybody listening. Don't forget, you can go to patreon.com/amberunmasked to financially back the show. And also my other work, you get the benefit of early access to the Cat Detective Files when they come out each week. And sometimes reviews. I'm still reviewing books. I'm just a very slow reader. Other than that, so the main, you know, my main personal blog and review stuff is at amberunmasked.com. And if you're interested in just my books, I set up a website finally that's just very basic and plain called elizabethamberwrites.com. But the cats, you can follow Gus and Oliver's adventures at catdetectivecases.com. That way they have, there was just so much content for them that they needed their own domain. So, so catdetectivecases.com. And of course, follow on Instagram. You can see our daily adventures and what we get up to. So, all right, Emily, I hope to see you around again, you know, with these, you know, getting back out into public things.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I love going to conventions. I'm not going to quite as many this year, in large part because we don't have a book one right now. But I will be at least some of the cons, and I hope to see you there.
Okay, take care.
You too.